Conclusion, a summary of this book. I have taken the liberty once or twice of borrowing the excellent phrase about an outline of history, though this study of a special truth and a special error can, of course, claim no sort of comparison with a rich and many-sided encyclopedia of history for which that name was chosen. And yet there is a certain reason in the reference and a sense in which the one thing touches and even cuts across the other. For the story of the world as told by Mr. Wells could here only be criticized as an outline, and strangely enough, it seems to me that it is only wrong as an outline. It is admirable as an accumulation of history. It is splendid as a storehouse or treasury of history. It is a fascinating disquisition on history. It is most attractive as an amplification of history, but it is quite false as an outline of history. The one thing that seems to me quite wrong about it is the outline, the sort of outline that can really be a single line like that which makes all the difference between a caricature of the profile of Mr. Winston Churchill and of Sir Alfred Mond. In simple and homely language, I mean the things that stick out, the things that make the simplicity of a silhouette. I think the proportions are wrong, the proportions of what is certain as compared with what is uncertain, of what played a great part as compared with what played a smaller part, of what is ordinary and what is extraordinary, of what really lies level with an average and what stands out as an exception. I do not say it as a small criticism of a great writer, and I have no reason to do so, for in my own much smaller task, I feel I have failed in very much the same way. I am very doubtful whether I have conveyed to the reader the main point I meant about the proportions of history, and why I have dwelt so much more on some things than others. I doubt whether I have clearly fulfilled the plan that I set out in the introductory chapter, and for that reason I add these lines as a sort of summary in a concluding chapter. I do believe that the things on which I have insisted are more essential to an outline of history than the things which I have subordinated or dismissed. I do not believe that the past is most truly pictured as a thing in which humanity merely fades away into nature, or civilization merely fades away into barbarism, or religion fades away into mythology, or our own religion fades away into the religions of the world. In short, I do not believe that the best way to produce an outline of history is to rub out the lines. I believe that of the two, it would be far nearer the truth to tell the tale very simply, like a primitive myth about a man who made the sun and stars, or a god who entered the body of a sacred monkey. I will therefore sum up all that has gone before in what seems to me a realistic and reasonably proportioned statement, the short story of mankind. In the land lit by that neighboring star whose blaze is the broad daylight, there are many and very various things, motionless and moving. There moves among them a race that is, in its relation to others, a race of gods. The fact is not lessened, but emphasized, because it can behave like a race of demons. Its distinction is not an individual illusion, like one bird pluming itself on its own plumes. It is a solid and a many-sided thing. It is demonstrated in the very speculations that have led to its being denied. That men, the gods of this lower world, are linked with it in various ways is true, but it is another aspect of the same truth. That they grow as the grass grows and walk as the beasts walk is a secondary necessity that sharpens the primary distinction. It is like saying that a magician must, after all, have the appearance of a man, or that even the fairies could not dance without feet. It has lately been the fashion to focus the mind entirely on these mild and subordinate resemblances and to forget the main fact altogether. It is customary to insist that man resembles the other creatures, yes, and that very resemblance he alone can see. The fish does not trace the fishbone pattern in the fowls of the air, or the elephant and the emu compare skeletons. even in the sense in which man is at one with the universe, it is an utterly lonely universality. The very sense that he is united with all things is enough to sunder him from all. Looking around him by this unique light, as lonely as the literal flame that he alone has kindled, this demigod or demon of the visible world makes that world visible. He sees around him a world of a certain style or type. It seems to proceed by certain rules or at least repetitions. He sees a green architecture that builds itself without visible hands, but which builds itself into a very exact plan or pattern, like a design already drawn in the air by an invisible finger. It is not, as is now vaguely suggested, a vague thing. It is not a growth or a groping of blind life. Each seeks an end, a glorious and radiant end, even for every daisy or dandelion we see in looking across the level of a common field. In the very shape of things, there is more than green growth. There is the finality of the flower. It is a world of crowns. This impression, whether or no it be an illusion, has so profoundly influenced this race of thinkers and masters of the material world that the vast majority have been moved to take a certain view of the world. They have concluded, rightly or wrongly, that the world had a plan, as the tree seemed to have a plan, and an end, and crown like the flower. But so long as the race of thinkers was able to think, it was obvious that the admission of this idea of a plan brought with it another thought, more thrilling and even terrible. There was someone else, some strange and unseen being who had designed these things, if indeed they were designed. There was a stranger who was also a friend, a mysterious benefactor who had been before them and built up the woods and hills for their coming, and had kindled the sunrise against their rising as a servant kindles a fire. Now this idea of a mind that gives a meaning to the universe has received more and more confirmation within the minds of men by meditations and experiences much more subtle and searching than any such argument about the external plan of the world. But I am concerned here with keeping the story in its most simple and even concrete terms. And it is enough to say here that most men, including the wisest men, have come to the conclusion that the world has such a final purpose and therefore such a first cause. But most men, in some sense, separated themselves from the wisest men when it came to the treatment of that idea. There came into existence two ways of treating that idea, which between them made up most of the religious history of the world. The majority, like the minority, had this strong sense of a second meaning in things, of a strange master who knew the secret of the world. But the majority, the mob or mass of men, naturally tended to treat it rather in the spirit of gossip. The gossip, like all gossip, contained a great deal of truth and falsehood. The world began to tell itself tales about the unknown being or his sons or servants or messengers. Some of the tales may truly be called old wives' tales, as professing only to be very remote memories of the morning of the world, myths about the baby moon or the half-baked mountains. Some of them might more truly be called travelers' tales, as being curious but contemporary tales brought from certain borderlands of experience, such as miraculous cures, or those that bring whispers of what has happened to the dead. Many of them are probably true tales. Enough of them are probably true to keep a person of real common sense more or less conscious that there really is something rather marvelous behind the cosmic curtain. But in a sense, it is only going by appearances, even if the appearances are called apparitions. It is a matter of appearances and disappearances. At the most, these gods are ghosts, that is, they are glimpses. For most of us, they are rather gossip about glimpses. And for the rest, The whole world is full of rumors, most of which are almost avowedly romances. The great majority of the tales about gods and ghosts and the invisible king are told, if not for the sake of the tale, at least for the sake of the topic. They are evidence of the eternal interest of the theme. They are not evidence of anything else, and they are not meant to be. They are mythology, or the poetry that is not bound in books, or bound in any other way. Meanwhile, the minority, the sages or thinkers, had withdrawn apart and had taken up an equally congenial trade. They were drawing up plans of the world which all believed to have a plan. They were trying to set forth the plan seriously and to scale. They were setting their minds directly to the mind that had made the mysterious world, considering what sort of a mind it might be and what its ultimate purpose might be. Some of them made that mind much more impersonal than mankind has generally made it. Some simplified it almost to a blank. A few, a very few, doubted it altogether. One or two of the more morbid fancied that it might be evil and an enemy. Just one or two of the more degraded in the other class worship demons instead of gods. But most of these theorists were theists, and they not only saw a moral plan in nature, but they generally laid down a moral plan for humanity. Most of them were good men who did good work, and they were remembered and reverenced in various ways. They were scribes, and their scriptures became more or less holy scriptures. They were lawgivers, and their tradition became not only legal but ceremonial. We may say that they received divine honors in the sense in which kings and great captains in certain countries often receive divine honors. In a word, wherever the other popular spirit, the spirit of legend and gossip, could come into play, it surrounded them with the more mystical atmosphere of the myths. Popular poetry turned the sages into saints, but that was all it did. They remained themselves. Men never really forgot that they were men, only made into gods in the sense that they were made into heroes. Divine Plato, like Divo Caesar, was a title and not a dogma. In Asia, where the atmosphere was more mythological, the man was made to look more like a myth, but he remained a man. He remained a man of a certain special class or school of men, receiving and deserving great honor from mankind. It is the order or school of the philosophers, the men who have set themselves seriously to trace the order across any apparent chaos in the vision of life. Instead of living on imaginative rumors and remote traditions and the tail end of exceptional experiences about the mind and meaning behind the world, they have tried, in a sense, to project the primary purpose of that mind a priori. They have tried to put on paper a possible plan of the world, almost as if the world were not yet made. Right in the middle of all these things stands up an enormous exception. It is quite unlike anything else. It is a thing final, like the trump of doom, though it is also a piece of good news, or news that seems too good to be true. It is nothing less than the loud assertion that this mysterious maker of the world has visited his world in person. It declares that really and even recently, or right in the middle of historic times, there did walk into the world this original, invisible being, about whom the thinkers make theories, and the mythologies hand down myths, the man who made the world. That such a higher personality exists behind all things had indeed always been implied by all the best thinkers, as well as by all the most beautiful legends. But nothing of this sort had ever been implied in any of them. It is simply false to say that the other sages and heroes had claimed to be that mysterious master and maker of whom the world had dreamed and disputed. Not one of them had ever claimed to be anything of the sort. Not one of their sects or schools had ever claimed that they had claimed to be anything of the sort. The most that any religious prophet had said was that he was the true servant of such a being. The most that any visionary had ever said was that men might catch glimpses of the glory of that spiritual being, or much more often of lesser spiritual beings. The most that any primitive myth had ever suggested was that the Creator was present at the creation. But that the Creator was present at scenes a little subsequent to the supper parties of Horus, and talked with tax collectors and government officials in the detailed daily life of the Roman Empire, and that this fact continued to be firmly asserted by the whole of that great civilization for more than 1,000 years, that is something utterly unlike anything else in nature. It is the one great, startling statement that man has made since he spoke his first articulate word instead of barking like a dog. Its unique character can be used as an argument against it as well as for it. It would be easy to concentrate on it as a case of isolated insanity, but it makes nothing but dust and nonsense of comparative religion. It came on the world with a wind and rush of running messengers proclaiming that apocalyptic portent, and it is not unduly fanciful to say that they are running still. What puzzles the world and its wise philosophers and fanciful pagan poets about the priests and people of the Catholic Church is that they still behave as if they were messengers. A messenger does not dream about what his message might be or argue about what it probably would be. He delivers it as it is. It is not a theory or a fancy, but a fact. It is not relevant to this intentionally rudimentary outline to prove in detail that it is a fact, but merely to point out that these messengers do deal with it as men deal with a fact. All that is condemned in Catholic tradition, authority and dogmatism, and the refusal to retract and modify are but the natural human attributes of a man with a message relating to a fact. I desire to avoid, in this last summary, all the controversial complexities that may once more cloud the simple lines of that strange story, which I have already called in words that are much too weak, the strangest story in the world. I desire merely to mark those main lines, and specially to mark where the great line is really to be drawn. The religion of the world, in its right proportions, is not divided into fine shades of mysticism or more or less rational forms of mythology. It is divided by the line between the men who are bringing that message and the men who have not yet heard it or cannot yet believe it. But when we translate the terms of that strange tale back into the more concrete and complicated terminology of our time, we find it covered by names and memories of which the very familiarity is a falsification. For instance, when we say that a country contains so many Muslims, we really mean that it contains so many monotheists. And we really mean by that it contains so many man-men with the old average assumption of men that the invisible ruler remains invisible. They hold it along with the customs of a certain culture and under the simpler laws of a certain lawgiver. But so they would if their lawgiver were Lycurgus or Solon. They testify to something which is a necessary and noble truth, but was never a new truth. Their creed is not a new color. It is the neutral and normal tint that is the background of the many-colored life of man. Muhammad did not, like the Magi, find a new star. He saw through his own particular window a glimpse of the great gray field of the ancient starlight. So when we say that the country contains so many Confucians or Buddhists, we mean it contains so many pagans whose prophets have given them another and rather vaguer version of the invisible power, making it not only invisible, but also impersonal. When we say that they also have temples and idols and priests and periodical festivals, we simply mean that this sort of heathen is enough of a human being to admit the popular element of pomp and pictures and feasts and fairy tales. We only mean that pagans have more sense than Puritans, but what the gods are supposed to be, what the priests are commissioned to say, is not a sensational secret like what those running messengers of the gospel had to say. Nobody else except those messengers has any gospel. Nobody else has any good news, for the simple reason that nobody else has any news. Those runners gather impetus as they run. Ages afterwards, they still speak as if something had just happened. They have not lost the speed and momentum of messengers. They have hardly lost, as it were, the wild eyes of witnesses. In the Catholic Church, which is the cohort of the message, there are still those headlong acts of holiness that speak of something rapid and recent, a self-sacrifice that startles the world like a suicide. But it is not a suicide. It is not pessimistic. It is still as optimistic as St. Francis of the Flowers and Birds. It is newer in spirit than the newest schools of thought, and it is almost certainly on the eve of new triumphs. For these men serve a mother who seems to grow more beautiful as new generations rise up and call her blessed. We might sometimes fancy that the Church grows younger as the world grows old. For this is the last proof of the miracle, that something so supernatural should have become so natural. I mean that anything so unique when seen from the outside should only seem universal when seen from the inside. I have not minimized the scale of the miracle, as some of our milder theologians think it wise to do. Rather, have I deliberately dwelt on that incredible interruption as a blow that broke the very backbone of history. I have great sympathy with the monotheists, the Muslims, the Jews, to whom it seems a blasphemy that might shake the world. But it did not shake the world, it steadied the world. The fact, the more we consider it, would seem more solid and more strange. I think it a piece of plain justice to all the unbelievers to insist upon the audacity of the act of faith that is demanded of them. I willingly and warmly agree that it is in itself a suggestion at which we might expect even the brain of the believer to reel when he realized his own belief. But the brain of the believer does not reel. It is the brains of the unbelievers that reel. We can see their brains reeling on every side and into every extravagance of ethics and psychology, into pessimism and the denial of life, into pragmatism and the denial of logic, seeking their omens in nightmares and their canons in contradictions, shrieking for fear at the far-off sight of things beyond good and evil, or whispering of strange stars where two and two make five. Meanwhile, this solitary thing that seems at first so outrageous in outline remains solid and sane in substance. It remains the moderator of all these manias, rescuing reason from the pragmatists exactly as it rescued laughter from the Puritans. I repeat that I have deliberately emphasized its intrinsically defiant and dogmatic character. The mystery is how anything so startling should have remained defiant and dogmatic and yet become perfectly normal and natural. I have admitted freely that, considering the incident in itself, a man who says he is God may be classed with the man who says he is glass. But the man who says he is glass is not a glazier, making windows for all the world. He does not remain for after ages as a shining and crystalline figure in whose light everything is as clear as crystal. But this madness has remained sane. The madness has remained sane when everything else went mad. The madhouse has been a house to which, age after age, men are continually coming back as to a home. That is the riddle that remains, that anything so abrupt and abnormal should still be found a habitable and hospitable thing. I care not if the skeptic says it is a tall story. I cannot see how so toppling a tower could stand so long without foundation. Still less can I see how it could become, as it has become, the home of man. Had it merely appeared and disappeared, it might possibly have been remembered or explained as the last leap of the rage of illusion, the ultimate myth of the ultimate mood in which the mind struck the sky and broke. but the mind did not break. It is the one mind that remains unbroken in the breakup of the world. If it were an error, it seems as if the error could hardly have lasted a day. If it were a mere ecstasy, it would seem that such an ecstasy could not endure for an hour. It has endured for nearly 2,000 years, and the world within it has been more lucid, more level-headed, more reasonable in its hopes, more healthy in its instincts, more humorous and cheerful in the face of fate and death than all the world outside. For it was the soul of Christendom that came forth from the incredible Christ, and the soul of it was common sense. Though we dared not look on his face, we could look on his fruits, and by his fruits we should know him. The fruits are solid, and the fruitfulness is much more than a metaphor. And nowhere in this sad world are boys happier in apple trees or men in more equal chorus singing as they tread the vine than under the fixed flash of this instant and intolerant enlightenment, the lightning made eternal as the light. This concludes this recording of The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Sound recording by Al Kovaya. Copyright 1995 by St. Joseph's Communications Incorporated. It is expressly forbidden to copy or reproduce this recording in any manner or form. If you are interested in a free catalog of more fine Catholic tapes, please write to St. Joseph's Communications Incorporated, P.O. Box 720, West Covina, California, zip code 91793, or you may call us at area code 818-331-3549. Thank you, and God bless you.